It was the morning of the following day. My months in the book had passed in as much time as it takes to read them. The Welsh Politburo, alerted to the wrongdoings on their doorstep, had given Victor Finisterre and a member of the Bronte Federation a safe conduct to the mouldering Penderyn Hotel, where they now stood with Bowden, Mycroft, and an increasingly nervous Jack Shit. The representative of the Bronte Federation was reading the words as they appeared on the yellowed manuscript in front of him. Aside from a few minor changes, the book was travelling the same course it always did. It had been word-perfect for the past 2 hours. Jane was being proposed to by St. John Rivers, who wanted her to go with him to India as his wife, and she was about to make up her mind. Mycroft drummed his fingers on the desk and glanced at the rows of flicking dials on his contraption. All he needed was somewhere to open the door. Trouble was, they were fast running out of pages. Then the miraculous happened. The Bronte Federation expert, a small, usually unexcitable man named Plink, was suddenly ignited by shock.
"Wait a minute! This is new! This didn't happen!"
"What?" cried Victor, rapidly flicking to his own copy. Indeed, Mr. Plink was correct. There, as the words etched themselves across the paper, was a new development in the narrative. After Jane promised St. John Rivers that if it was God's will that they should be married, then they would, there was a voice, a new voice, Rochester's voice, calling to her across the ether. But from where? It was a question that was being asked simultaneously by nearly 80 million people worldwide, all following the new story unfolding in front of their eyes.
"What does it mean?" asked Victor.
"I don't know," replied Plink. "It's pure Charlotte Bronte, but it definitely wasn't there before."
"Thursday," murmured Victor. "It has to be.
Mycroft, stay on your toes."
They read delightedly, as Jane changed her mind about India and St. John Rivers, and decided to return to Thornfield. I made it back to Ferndean and Rochester just before Jane did. I met Rochester in the dining room and told him the news, how I had found her at the Rivers house, gone to her window and barked, "Jane, Jane, Jane," in a hoarse whisper, the way that Rochester did. It wasn't a good impersonation, but it did the trick. I saw Jane start to fluster and pack almost immediately. Rochester seemed less excited about the news.
"I don't know whether I should thank you or curse you, Miss Next. To think that I should be seen like this, a blind man with one good arm, and Thornfield a ruin. She shall hate me, I know it."
"You are wrong, Mr. Rochester, and if you know Jane as well as I think you do, you would not even begin to entertain such thoughts." There was a rap at the door. It was Mary. She announced that Rochester had a visitor, but that they would not give their name.
"Oh, Lord!" exclaimed Rochester. "It's her. Tell me, Miss Next, could she love me? Like this, I mean."
I leaned across and kissed his forehead. "Of course she could. Anyone could. Mary, refuse her entry. If I know her, she will enter anyway. Goodbye, Mr. Rochester. I can think of no way to thank you, so I shall just say that you and Jane will be in my thoughts always." Rochester moved his head, trying to gauge where I was by sound alone. He put out his hand and held mine tightly. He was warm to the touch, yet soft. Thoughts of Landon entered my mind.
"Farewell, Miss Next. You have a great heart. Do not let it go to waste. You have one who loves you and whom you love yourself. Choose happiness."
I slipped quickly out into the adjoining room as Jane entered. I quietly latched the door, as Rochester did a fine job of pretending that he didn't know who she was.
"Give me the water, Mary," I heard him say.
There was a rustle, and then I heard Pilot padding about.
"What is the matter?"
asked Rochester, in his most annoyed and gruff expression. I stifled a giggle.
"Down, Pilot," said Jane.
The dog was quiet, and there was a pause.
"This is you, Mary, is it not?" asked Rochester.
"Mary is in the kitchen," replied Jane.
I pulled the now battered manual out of my pocket with the slightly charred poem. I still had Jack Shit to contend with, but that would have to wait. I sat down on a chair as an exclamation from Rochester made its way through the door.
"Who is it? What is it? Who speaks?"
I strained to hear the conversation.
"Pilot knows me,"
returned Jane happily. "And John and Mary know I am here. I came only this afternoon."
"Great God!" exclaimed Rochester. "What delusion has come over me? What sweet madness has seized me?"
I whispered, "Thank you, Edward," as the portal opened in the corner of the room. I took one last look around at a place to which I would never return, and stepped through. There was a flash and a blast of static. Ferndean Manor was gone, and in its place I saw the familiar surroundings of the shabby lounge of the Penderin Hotel. Bowden, Mycroft and Victor all rushed forward to greet me. I handed the manual and poem to Mycroft, who swiftly set about opening the door to I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud.
"Hades?" asked Victor.
"Dead."
"Completely?"
"Utterly." In a few moments the prose portal reopened and Mycroft rushed inside, returning shortly afterwards, clutching Polly by the hand. She was holding a bunch of daffodils and trying to explain something.
"We were just talking, Crofty, my love. You don't think I would be interested in a dead poet, do you?"
"My turn," said Jack Shit excitedly, waving his copy of The Plasma Rifle in War.
He placed it with the bookworms and signalled to Mycroft to open the portal. As soon as the worms had done their work, Mycroft did as he was bid. Shit grinned and reached through the shimmering white doorway, feeling around for one of the plasma rifles that had been so well described in the book. Bowden had other ideas. He gave him a small shove, and Jack Shit disappeared through the doorway with a yell. Bowden nodded at Mycroft, who pulled the plug. The machine fell silent, the gateway to the book severed. It was bad timing on Jack Shit's behalf. In his eagerness to get his hands on the rifle, he had not made sure his Goliath officers were with him. By the time the two guards had returned, Bowden was assisting Mycroft in smashing the prose portal, after carefully transferring the bookworms and returning the original manuscript of Jane Eyre, the ending now slightly altered, to the Bronte Federation.
"Where's Colonel Shit?" asked the first officer.
Victor shrugged. "He went away. Something to do with plasma rifles."
The Goliath officers would have asked more questions, but the Welsh Foreign Secretary himself had arrived and announced that since the matter was now resolved, we would be escorted from the Republic. The Goliath operative started to argue, but was soon ushered from the room by several members of the Welsh Republican Army, who were definitely not impressed by their threats. We were driven in the presidential limousine out of Merthyr and dropped in Abertawe. The Bronte Federation representative was icily quiet during the entire trip. I sensed he wasn't that happy about the new ending. When we got to the town, I gave him the slip, ran to my car, and hastily drove back to Swindon, Rochester's words ringing in my ears. Landon's marriage to Daisy was happening at 3 that afternoon, and I was sure as hell going to be there.
Chapter 35. Nearly the end of our book. I had disrupted Jane Eyre quite considerably. My cry of Jane, Jane, Jane at her window had altered the book for good. It was against my training, against everything that I had sworn to uphold. I didn't see it as anything more than a simple act of contrition for what I felt was my responsibility over Rochester's wounds and the burning of Thornfield. I had acted out of compassion, not duty, and sometimes that is no bad thing. Thursday next, private diaries. At 3:05 I screeched to a halt outside the church of Our Blessed Lady of the Lobsters, much to the surprise of the photographer and the driver of a large Hispano-Suiza that was parked in readiness for the happy couple. I took a deep breath, paused to gather my thoughts, and, shaking slightly, walked up the steps to the main doors. The organ music was playing loudly, and my pace, which up to that point had been a run, suddenly slowed as my nerve abandoned me. What the hell was I playing at? Did I think I had any real chance of appearing from nowhere after a 10-year absence and then expecting the man I was once in love with just to drop everything and marry me?
"Oh, yes," said a woman to her companion as they walked past me. "Landon and Daisy are so much in love."
My walk slowed to a snail's pace as I found myself hoping to be too late and have the burden of decision taken from me. The church was full, and I slid unnoticed into the back, just next to the lobster-shaped font.
I could see Landon and Daisy at the font, attended to by a small bevy of pages and bridesmaids. There were many uniformed guests in the small church, friends of Landon's from the Crimea. I could see someone whom I took to be Daisy's mother snivelling into her handkerchief, looking impatiently at his watch. On Landon's side, his mother was on her own.
"I require and charge you both," the clergyman was saying, "that if either of you know any impediment why ye may not be lawfully joined together in matrimony, ye do now confess it."
He paused, and several guests shuffled. Mr. Mutler, whose lack of chin had been amply compensated by increased girth in his neck, seemed ill at ease and looked about the church nervously. The clergyman turned to Landon and opened his mouth to speak, but as he did so there came a loud, clear voice from the back of the church.
"The marriage cannot go on. I declare the existence of an impediment."
150 heads turned to see who the speaker was. One of Landon's friends laughed out loud. He obviously thought it was a joke. The speaker's countenance did not, however, look as though any humour was intended. Daisy's father was having none of it. Landon was a good catch for his daughter, and a small and tasteless joke was not going to delay her wedding.
"Proceed,"
he said, his face like thunder. The clergyman looked at the speaker, then at Daisy and Landon, and finally at Mr. Mutler.
"I cannot proceed without some investigation into what has been asserted and evidence of its truth or falsehood," he said with a pained expression. Nothing like this had ever happened to him before.
Mr. Mutler had turned an unhealthy shade of crimson and might have struck the speaker had he been close enough.
"What is this nonsense?"
he shouted instead, setting the room buzzing.
"Not nonsense, sir," replied the speaker in a clear voice. "Bigamy is hardly nonsense, I think, sir."
I stared at Landon, who looked confused at the turn of events. Was he married already? I couldn't believe it. I looked back at the speaker and my heart missed a beat. It was Mr. Briggs, the solicitor I had last seen in the church at Thornfield. There was a rustle close by, and I turned to find Mrs. Nakajima standing next to me. She smiled and raised a finger to her lips. I frowned, and the clergyman spoke again.
"What is the nature of this impediment? Perhaps it may be got over, explained away."
"Hardly," was the answer. "I have called it insuperable, and I speak advisedly. It consists simply of a previous marriage."
Landon and Daisy looked at one another sharply.
"Who the hell are you?"
asked Mr. Mutler, who seemed to be the only person galvanised into action.
"My name is Briggs, a solicitor of Dash Street, London."
"Well, Mr. Briggs, perhaps you would be good enough to explain the previous marriage of Mr. Park Lane, so we may all know the extent of this man's cowardly action."
Briggs looked at Mr. Mutler, and then at the couple at the altar. "My information does not concern Mr. Park Lane. I am speaking of Miss Mutler, or, to give her her married name, Mrs. Daisy Posh."
There was a gasp from the congregation. Landon looked at Daisy, who threw her garland on the floor. One of the bridesmaids started to cry, and Mr. Mutler strode forward and took Daisy's arm.
"Miss Mutler married Mr. Murray Posh on 20th October 1981, yelled Mr. Briggs above the uproar. "The service was held at Southwark. There was no divorce petition filed." It was enough for everyone. A clamour started up as the Mutler family beat a hasty retreat. The vicar offered an unheard-of prayer to no one in particular, as Landon took a much-needed seat on the pew that the Mutler family had just vacated. Someone yelled, "Gold digger!" from the back, and the Mutler family quickened their pace at the abuse that followed, much of which shouldn't have been heard in church. One of the pages tried to kiss a bridesmaid in the confusion and was slapped for his trouble. I leaned against the cool stone of the church and wiped the tears from my eyes. I know it was wrong of me, but I was laughing. Briggs stepped through the arguing guests and joined us, tipping his hat respectfully.
"Good afternoon, Miss Next."
"A very good afternoon, Mr. Briggs. What on earth are you doing here?"
"The Rochesters sent me."
"But I only left the book 3 hours ago." Mrs. Nakajima interrupted.